Hello and welcome to Money Control. This is Priyanka Sahai and you are tuned into Setting Sail, our weekly podcast that dives through the changing landscape of the entrepreneurship ecosystem and the challenges within. The pandemic has not just made life difficult for the entrepreneurs, but also for the venture capital firms who mostly have to adhere to video conferencing to close the deals. But early stage investor 314 Capital is not in a mood to complain. Let's hear from Pranav Pai, founding partner of the fund, on what he thinks of the current situation. Hi Pranav, thank you so much for taking time out for us.
Thank you Priyanka, great to be here.
Pranav, do you think it's a good time to be an investor in India?
I think it's a fantastic time. I think the Indian startup ecosystem is now globally regarded as amongst the top three in the world. Last year in 2019, as you know, we received record amounts of venture capital funding, $14.5 billion. We're the third largest in terms of venture capital concentration as well. Only the US and China are larger in scale. So I think India's time has definitely come. And I think we're off to a very interesting new decade, which will offer many different opportunities for global investors from a startup and growth perspective.
Taking into perspective the FDI issue that has been created for the Chinese investors, or for that matter, the ban of Chinese app in India. Do you see all of this as an opportunity for both the domestic startups as well as domestic investors?
It's a good question, Priyanka. We speak to global investors almost every day. And an interesting observation I made is that almost every investor we meet when this issue comes up understands that India had good, strong reasons and a fundamental basis for why it made these decisions. Of course, on issues like national security, border sovereignty, and of course, data privacy and so on, every country in the world has shown that it will take these issues with utmost seriousness. The US has considered similar policy decisions, as you've seen in the headlines. Japan has. Many countries in the world are now re-examining their policies along these lines. So I don't think anyone in the world is surprised when India made these announcements. From a startup perspective, I would say I fundamentally believe Indian startups are much more resilient than most would assume. And of course, as I had mentioned earlier, the ecosystem benefited, especially with 2019's record amount of funding. So most of the companies, the market leaders, the large startups, when they entered 2020, had fairly strong balance sheets. And as we've seen with data over the last 6 months, even though the funding has not been as aggressive as last year for understandable reasons, the startups have managed to adapt. They've managed to evolve their business models. They've managed to balance growth and profitability. So I'm a firm believer that India's startup ecosystem is very resilient, and they should be able to deal with a temporary or interim interruption in funding like this. I'm not sure when or how these policy moves may change. Of course, none of us can predict that. But I'm fairly confident that Indian startups will attract global capital from elsewhere. And this interruption should be only temporary.
But would you say that this development gives an edge to the domestic investors as well? Is that the valuations have further become more realistic? Is that you're getting the creamier lot of all? Has things improved further as it was compared to all these ban?
Yeah, it's another fair question. I would say, Priyanka, from our perspective, and this is true for, I think, any ecosystem, the most of the capital in our startup ecosystem is looking for those prime candidates, those winning business models, those winning startups, those winning ideas. And the amount of interest in those market leaders or those potential market leaders, or sometimes if you're lucky, even the category creators, they are continuing to see as much interest when they go into the market to raise as they were even last year. So I don't think the slowdown has been uniform across all sectors, across all stages, and for all startups. I am certainly seeing that the best startups, even today in the middle of all of the macro events going on, when they are going to talk to investors and if they're making strong progress, which many of them are, they are receiving as much interest in their next rounds. They are receiving, in fact, more interest because the capital wants to concentrate in these quality companies. And actually, there isn't any valuation deterioration there. They're able to justify a reasonable valuation. And I'm sure you've seen the recent headlines. We've made some fantastic, for example, EdTech has had a fantastic set of new investors and new rounds being announced. I think that is not surprising. These are fantastic companies. These are companies that have done very well to create categories, large categories in this country. So I'm seeing similar trends across market leaders in very many sectors across the ecosystem. Of course, the downside of that is because capital wants to concentrate and chase these winners or these potential market leaders, that means there's less capital available on average for startups in very new sectors or startups that are very early. So yes, there's been a sort of slowdown, but I would not say it's uniform for all companies, certainly not for the market leaders.
What are your LPs saying? You are sitting on your third fund. It's a $100 million fund. Is there any specific concern that you're having from your LPs? What is the sort of vision that they have for the Indian market?
Yeah, it's been a great experience for us to work with our LPs to build the kind of early stage platform that we have over the last half a decade. We've taken away three major lessons from them, and we've made sure to imbibe these lessons into every new portfolio that we construct. I think the most important thing for LPs is to understand how a firm or a team like ours is thinking about finding quality, discovering quality, screening for great ideas, building a fund founder fit, and of course, establishing a core platform of values, of ideals that you don't deviate from. So we've been fortunate to have excellent institutional LPs from all over the world, from the US, from Japan, of course, from India. We're fortunate to be working with some of the strongest promoter groups in India, their family offices. So that's been a very interesting experience for us. And even through 2020, it's been a difficult 2020 so far. Even through 2020, they've been excellent supporters of ours. They've definitely come forward with support to ensure that they can work with some of our portfolio's founders also directly, give them advice, give them mentorship, talk about how they can deal with some of these issues. So I think our LPs are particularly very interested in working with us, with our investments, with our founders for the long run. So certainly that long-term orientation for India, that's been very interesting for us to see over the last half a decade. The second very interesting thing that we've learned from them from a global perspective is that there are no more doubts about India as an allocation globally. So if you're a US allocator, maybe from 2005 to 2015, the only other large economy that was attractive compared to the US was China, right? And China has done a fantastic job of building a close to $20 trillion economy. They're one of the fastest, most consistently growing large economies in the world over the last 15 years. They are growing at close to 7 to 8% every year. And that's been a fantastic model. And of course, global allocators have made very good returns investing in the China growth story. But since 2015, I think India has also started getting more prominence in the global allocators' view. It is very clear now India will be the only other scale country getting from the single-digit trillions of GDP to the 10 trillion GDP mark. We are at 3 trillion today, just pre-pandemic. We were the fifth in the world now. We had beaten the UK. We had overtaken France. We're only behind the US, China, Japan, and Germany. The next country crossing 10 will most definitely be India. It won't be Germany. It won't be Japan. So that's an interesting observation we've made, and certainly that's explained why India is getting so much more attention from LPs globally, allocators globally in general, not just LPs. But the third very interesting thing I must say, Priyanka, and this is something all of us as Indians must think about and figure out how we will make it work. And it's not just the government's responsibility. It's every single industrialist, every company, it's every startup, it's every employee, is the question of if we are getting to 10 is not the right question. It's when are we getting to 10 trillion? That's the question we need to answer. Now, if we take 20 years to go from 3 trillion in GDP to 10 trillion in GDP, that's not a fantastic, very interesting growth story. It's a very standard, linear, it's market beta, right? It's a large country, there's a lot of consumption, it'll happen on its own. What we need to work on and think about, and this is where all LPs will ask the question, is what can India do differently to take it from $3 trillion in GDP to $10 trillion in half that time? Can we do it in 10 years? Can we do it by 2030? Or can we do it by 2032 or even 2035? Our only challenge is to make sure we include as many Indians as possible in the story, more women participation, more bottom-up growth, more inclusive growth. And if we do that right, I think the timing question, when does India become the 10 trillion economy? I think that we can answer with much more strength. So those are the three broad observations we made.
That sounds quite fascinating, Pranav. But let me ask you that. Given the current situation that the world is, reeling under, what really makes you think that India will be in a position to become a $10 trillion economy by, say, like 2030-32?
Good question, Priyanka. And that's something we think about a lot. Every time we have a team meeting, every time we do our primary research, Now, we've actually looked at different segments of the Indian economy. Most people think India is a large country, 130 crore people, 1.3 billion people. But you know, look at some very fundamental indicators. Only 1.5 to 2 trillion people, 2 crore people, I'm sorry, 1.5 to 2 crore people in India file for taxes every year. There are only 25 million families in India that are able to support what we would call middle income, right? Meaning white collar jobs, enough salary to support a family of four or five. So a large number of Indians in our country today don't have that kind of uniform economic access that we should hope they have, that all of us have as citizens. So there is an inequality in terms of earning power, in terms of skill development, in terms of job access. So there is a big gap there, as all of us have all of us know and we have studied. And second, of course, important thing is that a lot of the new growth, right, a lot of the new value creation, the new wealth creation is being concentrated in those 25 million families. Is being concentrated in people who have that white collar job, who've had the opportunity to get good, decent schooling, go to college, earn a reasonable living, support their families. I don't think those opportunities are as widely distributed as we would have liked it to be. So there are challenges, of course, and that's something that we need to think about. How do we make the Indian economic story more inclusive? But again, the flip side of that and the good news is that I think we have a lot of the fundamental pillars already in place. So what has the government done over the last 10 years? We've spent 10 years, but today we have the India Stack, Jan Dhan, Aadhaar, UPI, DigiLocker, so on and so forth. All of these technologies were built in a way that has never been built anywhere in the world before. 1.2 billion Indians have an Aadhaar, have a unique identity. The government has distributed billions and billions of dollars, lakhs and lakhs of crores of rupees through DBT, direct beneficiary transfer, through the lockdown. In fact, that's one of the strongest use cases of the India Stack, of people getting direct benefits, cash to their account from the government without needing to line up, without going to queues, without waiting at ration shops, without waiting for someone to stamp and pay a bribe and so on and so forth. So a lot of these new interesting developments over the last 10 years have given us the fundamental pillars to start building that inclusive story. Now, of course, that's not the full story. That's not the full set of requirements we need to make sure the next 25 million families are also part of that $10 trillion GDP story. But I think we have the fundamentals in place. And if we are continuing as a country, from policy, from government, from administration, industry, job creation, startups, all of us, all different sectors of the country, if we are able to work together and continue to build on top of that momentum, I think that $10 trillion GDP story is definitely achievable. Again, I want to make it clear, we will get to 10 trillion. That's not going to be difficult. It's when we get to it, can we get to it faster? A lot of things need to come together to make that happen.
Okay, sounds quite interesting. Now, let me get back to your portfolio companies, Pranav. One of your very, I would say, star portfolio firm is Mitro TV. Now, something very fascinating about Mitro is that it just rose to fame overnight. Of course, the company was there for quite some time. They were building a robust app, but somehow they were at the right place at the right point in time. A lot of action happened when Mitro was not even officially launched. Their organic adoption happened miraculously overnight. How did Mitro happen for you? How did that funding happen?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, Priyanka, and I think it answers broadly to one of the most important parameters for venture capital growth in general, which is timing. So the funny thing about our journey with Mitro is we were introduced to them in April. So this is the height of the lockdown, as you remember. We were not in office. We could not, obviously, they were in Bangalore, so thankfully we could spend time with them, we could talk to them. But this is not a very typical environment to make a deal. And they had not even incorporated their company yet. So when we started talking to them, they were just two guys, of course, fantastic app developers. They had built something very unique in a time we had not seen too many people build such an app before. So from a product perspective, from a tech perspective, these are some of the sharpest founders we'd ever met. But they had not even incorporated a company yet. That's how early they were. So we decided to work with them. Of course, TikTok was very big, very prominent in India back then. This was before the China ban. So we took a long view on this and we said, there will need to be specialization, verticalization inside the short format video category in India. It's not going to be just one app like TikTok. There has to be differentiation. And we see many different ways, and I can spend time on that if that's of interest, but we saw many different ways in which Mitro could create a valuable subcategory inside short format video. So our goal with Mitro when we funded them was not to be the 400 million user strong giant that TikTok was. Even if we're able to get to 50 million users, we retain them well, we add value to their lives, that's a fairly valuable property, valuable asset to build. So of course we funded them. Siddharth, my partner who's our CFO, and our team literally worked with Shivang to make sure we incorporate the company with them, and that was a great experience. And then of course the China ban happened, and it may seem like it was serendipitous, of course, but that became almost a tailwind we couldn't fully just grapple with. From 2 million downloads to 35 million downloads happened in less than 2 months. And the fantastic thing about the story is they got that kind of growth without spending a single rupee in customer acquisition. Typically, Priyanka, as you know, when consumer app companies raise the 10, 20, 30 million dollar rounds, a large part of that round amount that they've raised, that equity, goes into customer acquisition, performance marketing, brand building, so on and so forth. This team, fascinatingly, had the advantage of getting to 30 million downloads without spending a single rupee, right? So if they would have had to raise $30 million to be able to get to this kind of user base. They got there barely raising 2-3 crores. And of course, they did a fantastic job of using that timing advantage to also raise the next round. They've got a fantastic new investor in place. They've been adding fantastic names to the cap table after that. And of course, the product is only getting better. The retention is getting better. They've started specializing in that vertical that they've built. So it's a very interesting story. I would say there are some things in venture that will surprise you every day. We also learn every day. And certainly when we can take advantage of timing, I'm very happy with the fact that this founding team was able to take that advantage.
Okay, that sounds actually quite fascinating. And having said that, let me also ask you that Mitro, of course, is not one of the only companies. There are so many other companies who are now trying to replicate the China model, trying to replicate the US model, trying to build something indigenous. But at the same time, the sad story is that they are trying to clone the models which have already been proven elsewhere. So let me ask you, give me an investor's perspective. Being an investor, do you feel more secure or more optimistic while funding these startups who are actually working on a model which has been proven abroad? Or you are open to experiment with new ideas, new products, which perhaps have been is being experimented for the first time?
Yeah, it's a great question, Priyanka. And look, as an investor, we have to be pragmatic. We will definitely have the option and sometimes a rare opportunity to work with founding teams that are trying to create a category. So for example, you know, of course, one of our portfolio companies, Delicious. Now, Abhay and Vivek have done a fantastic job of creating a brand new category in India, right? Completely bottom up, completely tech enabled. It's a fully vertical supply chain. It's a very intensive, very difficult, very challenging space to work in. But in 5 years, a 1,000 crore business, it's a fantastic company. And you know, I'm so proud of what those founders have done. And of course, those are rare opportunities. We don't see too many white spaces, too many categories that can be created that way. So we're pragmatic. Not all our investments can be category creators. But certainly on the other side of that, we have companies that have understood a very core, very fundamental white space or a core need that the incumbent companies, incumbent products, platforms are no longer supporting. Right? So for example, another very interesting company from our portfolio is Darwinbox. They are now one of India's fastest growing, most promising SaaS companies. And they've completely redefined a very old space, one of the oldest spaces in technology, HR tech. When we funded them, when we were part of the seed round in late 2015, early 2016, I spoke to many investors. We speak to investors every day. And it was almost hilarious to see their reaction. Most people didn't understand why you guys investing in an HR SaaS company. Right? HR is already a solved problem. There are multi-billion dollar technology giants doing HR, building HR technology, building the ERP systems. Why do you want to go after this space? It's already solved for it. But zoom out 4 or 5 years later, and Darwinbox has done so well. Again, a fantastic team. Rohit and Jayant have done excellently in building this company up. They've said they've broken all the milestones we set for them on their growth journey. And we're very proud, of course, that they've recreated a category that's so important. It's one of the core aspects of a corporate's technology procurement. So like I said, we will have those category creator opportunities. We'll also have the opportunity to reinvent a space, to rebuild for something when needs have changed, when trends have moved on. So with Mitro, I mean, I just want to conclude that by saying, for Mitro, like I told you, we funded Mitro when there was TikTok, when there was a large 400 million user strong giant in the ecosystem. Again, our fundamental feeling there was we have spoken to users, we look at how regional language users behave. Fundamentally, the content available to them is not as high quality as they deserve, as they want, right? Even if you look at TikTok, when it was around, most of the entertainment was very, most of the content was very mass entertainment. It was jokes, pranks. There's some vulgar content there. As you and I know, they were running into content moderation issues. That is not an ideal environment for short format video audio, the short format video audience in India. Why can't we have a higher quality destination? Why can't we have an Indian company that makes and promotes high quality creators and protects them in an ecosystem that is very pro creator, that is very pro high quality, right? That was our opportunity with Mitro, and that's what the founders wanted to build. They were very clear that yes, we may not get 400 million users, but the 30, 40, 50, 60 million, how many million users we get, this will be a great place for them to find the highest quality Indian language content. That was our goal. I'm very happy to say the founders have not changed their goal. TikTok, you know, we don't know what will happen with TikTok. They might sell to a US company, the domicile issues might change, and they might come back to India as a competitor. That's always possible, right? So we are not investing in these guys with the assumption that TikTok's there or not there. Our goal is we need to build a very brand new, very focused, very bottom-up strategy. And I'm full of kudos to the founders. Nothing has distracted them from building that very high-quality destination.
All right. So on that note, why don't you tell our listeners which other sectors are you actually keen to put your money in, and what sort of conversations are you in talks to, or are you already, you know, negotiating with entrepreneurs?
Fantastic. Of course, we've been very interested in five key areas over the last half a decade. We've done fantastic work in consumer companies like Lucius and Yulu and many more. We've done a lot of work in fintech. That's been one of our most active areas. And I'm very happy to be working with the companies we have in that space. Media and content has been a very interesting space for us. We've had a very, very fascinating journey building some fantastic companies, fantastic assets in that category. We've done very focused work in deep tech or IP development. And of course, we would like to do more, but it takes a long time to build a deep tech or IP heavy company, because those IP, that IP takes a long time to get to market and start generating revenues. But we've done quite a few in that space. And enterprise software, enterprise SaaS has been kind of bread and butter for us. That's a space we understand very well. I come from that background, the previous company I worked at. So that's something we like to do and we continue to do. What's changed with Fund 3, Priyanka, is there were two areas we were always very interested in. We had deep theses in. But somehow or the other, we never were able to be convinced about business model fit with what we wanted to go forward with. So, for example, one of those areas is health. And in spite of being very active in the health segment, we've spoken to hundreds of companies. We've never managed to do a full-scale investment in that space. We've only done one before, a company called Bugworks, which is in the antibiotic drug discovery space, very deep tech, very deep IP company. So we just announced our second, only our second health company early this week, a company called Dozy. They built a fantastic step-down ICU platform, a fully contactless sensor mat that goes underneath your mattress and is able to sense vital biosignals from your body in a contact-free manner. So it's one of the world's first step-down ICU platforms that we've seen. It's a fantastic engineering. We're very proud of what these founders have done. I think there's a big market for this. I think the future of health is going to be much more distributed, much more lightweight, much more agile. So we would love to do more in health. Dozy is only our second company, and we continue to be very excited about health going forward from 2020. Second interesting space that we've been looking at for a while, again, we've done only one company before, is agri-tech or ag-tech. We want to do a lot more here. We think the recent changes to the Essential Commodities Act opens up many new opportunities that were friction points before. So very happy to be looking at that space more aggressively. And hopefully we should be able to announce some new ideas there in the next couple of quarters.
All right. And on that note, Pranav, I would really like to thank you for taking time out for us.
Thank you, Priyanka. Have a good day.
So that's all that you have for this episode of Setting Sail. Meanwhile, if you have any comments or queries, you can write down to us. Our email is mcpodcast@nw18.com. You can also follow us on Twitter with our user IDs @moneycontrol.com and @PriyankaSahai. Till then, for more news, views and updates, stay logged on to moneycontrol.com.